You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Dr. Jess Cree about traditional indigenous medicinals and the cultural practices that go along with them and what they have to teach us about returning to health, sustainability, and balance with our planet in these times.
When you look at the land as a living organism, when you look at it as a living relative, when you look at the plants as healing us and providing us with medicine, their spirits are alive. When you look at the water as alive and as medicine, when you look at the rocks as healing and having wisdom, when you look at it from this indigenous perspective of everything being alive and that we're all related and we're all equal, it comes down to, you know, respect.
When God stood before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept love and loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Guanu, hello and welcome. Willigiscut, it's a beautiful day here in Bunawabskig territory. I am coming to you from along the shores of the beautiful Bunawabskig River here in central Maine, and I'm joined today, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. As our listeners know, we record our shows in advance, and today when we're recording is the first day of spring, so keep your eye on that. It will be a theme in this week's show, but the news around my house is that the bull snakes have woken up in the desert, the apricot tree is popping out its first blossoms, and we fired our mud oven outside and baked bread, so spring is here for us on this spring equinox. Today we're going to speak with Dr. Jess Cree, who is a practicing naturopathic physician, a Penobscot woman, and also has a degree in ethnobotany. We have a very exciting show, something that is tangible and practical and will apply to your lives, but comes out of the roots of her own indigenous tradition. So welcome to this show, Dr. Jess, and thank you for joining us.
Kwe Danakwak, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to have the opportunity to share with you today.
Jess, it's a great thrill for me to have you on the show. I've benefited from your knowledge myself and have received medicines from you to take care of my own well-being. And as Rivera said, we are here on the first day of spring, and all of our processes in regard to our way of life as Indigenous people is guided by the natural processes. And so as we enter into the spring, there's special knowledge that's associated with this time of year. And so as we begin, why don't we start off there with the wisdom of the spring and what that brings to our lives?
Yeah, so part of the discussion today is on traditional ecological knowledge and why this traditional knowledge from the Bunawabskig people that we come from is so important and brings so much light into our lives and the way we live, and it impacts our health and well-being. So as far as today being the first day of spring and the equinox, I just wanted to share some more traditional beliefs on spring and how this comes to be as far as our health and well-being and livelihoods. So as far as the equinox and the light and day being equal, this was all actually in our traditional stories as well, how that came to be. So I grew up with a story that my mom would tell of how the bear and chipmunk got into an argument and how the day and the night became equal. So these way that we look at ecology and the way we look at our environment is based off of our traditional oral history and our stories. So at this time of spring, there's many things happening. The crows and the birds are returning home. The maple syrup is beginning to flow. So it's a very ceremonial time for our people. We would begin to celebrate in ceremony the coming of the maple syrup. And we know how important maple syrup is for our health. We'll get into it a little bit further down the road as far as sugar and how much better for our health maple syrup is than sugar. Maple syrup actually has all of our key minerals, so it's actually therapeutic and beneficial for our health. We actually have stories as well as why the maple syrup came to us, why it's such a process to make. So again, this is all in our traditional stories of why and how we should be collecting our sap and our syrup and using it as everything for me is a naturopathic physician comes back to health and well-being, but the maple syrup is actually beneficial and therapeutic for our health. So many of these reasons of listening to our oral traditions from the beginning of time are really important for Wabanaki people, for all Indigenous peoples to remember our stories and to live the stories out as they are told, as our instructions tell us to live, because of the importance not only for our connection to the maple trees. We know that our Earth Mother loves us and that she gives us such a sweet, sweet blessing straight from the trees. And so just that alone, just that one piece of our traditional stories and our oral history and our connection to the land and using the trees as our medicine can provide us with so much. There's also so much more to spring. So at this time, our relative, the bear, is also emerging out of hibernation. At this time, it was also ceremonial that we would feast the bear and honor him and thank him for the medicines that he provides. In our tradition, my mom actually was the one who told me that the bear, when he's in his hibernation, he's in a dream state and he's dreaming of the medicines. And so when he emerges, we feast him and honor him because he's bringing these dreams into fruition so that we can now use these medicines and harvest these medicines. And when the bear emerges, he'll go directly to the medicine trees. And so by watching the bear over time and through thousands of years of history, we learn how to use the medicines to heal us from the bear. So we learned about digging roots and using the barks of trees and the importance of berries as our food and medicine from the bear. And so we honor the bear at this time for bringing us those medicines and teaching us about how to use those medicines. And so the bear is the keeper of many of the medicines that I use in my medical practice. And so we honor the bear at this time. Spring is also a time for us to fast and cleanse. So at this time, many people will seek their vision quest or go on a spiritual ceremonial fast. In my practice, for my patients, I also recommend actual detoxifications and cleansing at this time. Spring is a good time of renewal and fasting and cleansing. So we can actually gather the sassafras roots in early spring to help with detoxing and cleansing. We can also start to see the buds emerging on the trees, and those buds are actually good medicine and food as well. So me and my son will go gather maple buds, the maple flowers you can actually eat too. Poplar buds are actually good medicine as well, depending on what poplar tree you're looking at. So there's lots going on in spring, obviously, and we can start to get ready too for planting our seeds in our gardens, preparing our soils. We had Three Sisters gardens that would start the preparation come spring. We can now look forward to harvesting our wild foods. The fiddleheads will soon pop up, which is one of our first foods after our maple syrup. And other roots and greens that are edibles will start to emerge. The cattails, the skunk cabbage is edible. Lots of lily roots, some of the first foods that we see. the wild Indian cucumber. So we can start to gather a lot of these roots and tubers and early greens, the fiddleheads, the early green skunk cabbage leaves. It's also a time when the fish will return. So in traditional ecological knowledge, one thing that's really kind of fascinating is how the plants and the animals and the people, how we were all interrelated and connected. So there's actually a shrub called the shad bush, or some people could call it serviceberry. But the shad bush is one of the first trees to bloom, one of the first shrubs to bloom. And that will signify when the shad and the rivers start to make their way upriver. So the fish will start to return upriver. So in reading the environment and living with our environment, you can see the signs. So the crows will be the first birds to fly home. The shad bush, when it blooms, will signify the returning of the fish and the shad upriver. So traditionally, we were able to look for these signs in the environment. We would know when the maple syrup was ready. We would be totally connected to all of the foods, the medicine, and the animals, and a lot of that over time was passed down over the years to have significant knowledge and wisdom about pretty much every facet of life.
That is so amazing to hear all that. And from my own personal experience, watching our one apricot tree bloom right now and watching the snakes come out on the same day, it's such a tiny taste of the world that you're describing. And I know from that experience how rich and profound the journey into that world really can be. It stands in stark contrast with the dominant culture of the United States, which has really lost its bearings in most ways from that. If you're of European descent, then, you know, the older European cultures still had their own versions of those traditions. But in the history and the politics of this, so much was lost to conquest and colonization. And so I'm wondering if you would speak a little bit about that process and where it has left us today.
Yes. So I'll give you some of my personal background and how that's impacted my life. So my great-grandmother was Val Ranko, and she was born in 1912. And she was born on Orson Island, and she was raised by her grandparents. And so if you look at the geography, Orson Island is a remote island. It's only accessible by canoe. So it's an island in the Penobscot River. And so my great-grandmother was born and raised out there for the first 7 years of her life by her grandparents. And I was raised with her. She passed away at 96 years old in 2007. So for a great part of my life, I was raised by her. Not by her, but with her as a predominant figure, grandmother in my life. And so as I studied ethnobotany, I actually would interview her and ask her specifics about what it was like being raised on Orson Island. And she would tell me that her grandfather would always have traps in the backyard for dinner. And they would just go out in the morning and see what was in the trap and see what they were having for dinner. She would tell me about canoeing upriver for the summer months to go plant her gardens on Old Lemon. And so, if you look at the geography, Old Lemon Island is quite a distance north, and she would travel by canoe with her grandparents, and they were able actually at that time to drink the water right out of the river. So as a youth, she would be in the middle of the canoe and her grandparents on each bow, and she would ladle the water, the drinking water, on such a long canoe trip right directly from the river into their mouths. And so she was raised able to drink the water out of the river. She was raised with gardens and hunting and gathering. And so she told me stories of where they would go pick their berries. So they had it seasonally set up, what to do, where to go get these things, gathering medicines on Sugar Island, and where they would go to pick certain berries at certain times of year as they emerged, the strawberries and blueberries and raspberries and blackberries and all of those elderberries. And so she really lived by the seasons, and it was actually her life that she remembered going with her with her grandmother, who is Chi Maligla, who is Mary Clara Neptune. She told me about how they would go to the trading post to trade for baskets for food. And that food was flour and sugar and lard. And so she would go and they would have buckets of flour, buckets of sugar. And so that was when the transition started. And she would then also, for her, was when she had to go to school on Indian Island. So her first language was Penobscot, and she had to go to school to learn English. And it was at that transition of her school years where initially in the winter months, her grandfather would bring her on a sled on the frozen river to school. And so it just became too much. So she moved to the main, or the, it's not a mainland. She moved to Indian Island, which was the main island, I guess, the main island where there was more going on. So there was more access to the foods and the trading posts. So it was in her lifespan where they transitioned from hunting and gathering to pretty much going to grocery stores. And so, and I was raised by her. She didn't pass away till 2007. So when you think about that, it's not that long ago at all where we were living by and with the land. And so my story has, knowing that, knowing her, being raised by her, and then for my life, being raised predominantly by grocery stores, you know, in this colonized conventional world that we're living in now, the disconnect. So for me, a lot of my life has been trying to reconnect with the plants, with the medicines, because that is my passion. So as a teenager, I would go sit in the woods and just visit with the plants, learn about them, learn how to identify them, learn who they were, the spirit of the plant, the being. And I would just learn how to identify them, which ones were edible, which ones were medicinal. And so began my journey. And I went to school for ethnobotany. I created my own major because I went to UMass. They didn't have the major. So I created my own major in ethnobotany because I really wanted to study how our people use these plants. And so I sought them out. I sought out, you know, my grandmother, other elders, teachers who could teach me the traditional ways, and just picking up over time the stories, the knowledge. And then I went on to become a naturopathic doctor because my passion for herbal medicine was so strong. And so part of it is my own journey of reconnecting with the plants, with our traditional foods, understanding that our connection to the land is so full and complete, and we're still here on this land. And so with colonization and the acquisition of so much of our lost land, as Wabanaki people, my family went all the way down to southern Maine. So my family had villages in Kennebunkport, which is way southern Maine. And so part of that loss of land disrupts our ability to harvest our medicines. A lot of our traditional gathering places, our traditional farmlands, are not our land anymore. For example, you can just take Mount Katahdin as an example. So Mount Katahdin is our sacred mountain. I was told that this is where our plant spirits hold council. So our plant medicines and the spirits of those plants hold council at Katahdin. This is a very sacred place for us. And Mount Katahdin is a state park. So it's illegal for us to gather our medicines in our most sacred place of where our medicines reside and our spirits reside. You look at Acadia National Park. So the national park system has recently changed the law that prior nobody could harvest, no native person could harvest any medicine from national parks. And many national parks like Acadia National Park would be traditional places of gathering and hunting. So they recently changed the law that one designated person from the tribal nation can go and gather. It hasn't been enacted yet, but it's not nearly enough in my belief. So for a tribe to designate one tribal member to be allowed to harvest, to me is inadequate, and it's really kind of missing the point
I think that this is really important. I actually worked on some of that language and helped the Elders Council, to draft a statement regarding that legislation. And not only does it create these false hierarchies within our communities by designated only one individual, but mm-hmm. it separates everybody else from their traditional way of life. And it also diminishes the role of various clans. As you know, I'm Bear Clan. You sent me bear medicine recently when I was sick. You know, each clan has their own medicines that they keep. Mm-hmm. And so it also disrupts the balance within our communities that exists between the clans. And so it's really disruptive, and it's really, you know, a further act of assimilation and colonization to strip the people from their ability to be able to engage their way of life meaningfully. And I think that it's important to point out that this is a brand new law. This is still going on. So mm-hmm. rather than opening up the space to allow for Native people to reengage their traditional way of life, instead, they're overlaying and imposing this value system that's really based on hierarchy, which is completely foreign to our way of engagement with one another. I also wanted to mention that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the way that you were raised, I was raised right across from Orson Island, and many of the memories that you have are the same for me. You know, my grandfather hunted and trapped. We picked the berries. You know, we picked the tea leaves and all of the other medicinal plants. We picked fiddleheads. And, you know, I grew up with moose and deer being cut up right on the kitchen table with the whole family around. And so my grandfather actually ran the ferry between Indian Island and the mainland. And he also worked that sawdust bridge that people crossed over the ice in the wintertime. So there's so many similarities as you're talking about your upbringing with my own grandparents. And my grandmother was from Zibayik. So she knew about all of the traditional foods that they had along the coast in Zibayik, you know, and Acadia used to be our territory. Mm-hmm. Kennebunkport used to be our territory. All of these places were part of our migratory route as Wabanaki people. So I think it's just, it's so heartening for me to hear you talk about these things. And we just came off from the weekend of the Bear Feast, and to recognize how our ability to be able to continue to engage this way of life is still being so disrupted by the things that are going on. And so are there other ways that you've seen our way of life being disrupted and colonized through impositions on the medicines?
Mm-hmm. Yes, great deal. So actually, the USDA on their website has listed over 400 species in plant species in Maine that are either threatened or endangered. So many of our native medicinal plants from the Northeast are endangered and threatened. And many of these are very, very, very important medicines. So, for example, blue cohosh and black cohosh. Actually, cohosh is the Penobscot word for these plants. So they are super important in Wabanaki health. So especially women's plant medicine. So blue cohosh and black cohosh were used in our birthing, that we had traditional birthing at home with our elder moms and aunties and things as our midwives. So the cohosh plants are both endangered, both black cohosh and blue cohosh. Our trillium plant is also called birth root, and that is also endangered. Lady slipper is also an important medicinal woman's plant, is endangered. Golden seal is an important antimicrobial. It did extend up probably into more of southern Maine. That is endangered. Our chestnut trees. So I look at food as medicine as well. And so chestnut trees got completely wiped out by a blight. And so we haven't had any chestnuts for many years now. So the chestnuts, they are starting to make a comeback. However, it takes many, many years to get the actual nuts from the tree. So we're hoping that they will come back. But when so many of our medicinal plants and our food sources are actually endangered and threatened. It's a really big problem because so much of these plants are very important as our, as a naturopath, I use these plants as our primary care medicine. So they're not being used. We need to use them. The problem is we can't wild harvest them or source them from our traditional places. They would have to be grown at a farm at this point. I do not harvest any endangered native medicinals. And that's a really unfortunate thing because those plant spirits want to help us. Those are our indigenous allies. They're our friends. They're our spirits. They're our relatives. They want to help us. They want to help us heal. The cohoshes want to be used by women. And so when our own sources that we use for thousands of years are being exterminated pretty much, that's a major issue. We also have a lot of invasive plant species. So these invasive plants have been taking over our natural food sources. For example, the Phragmites is kind of like a grassy reed, and it's really taking over where all the cattails grow. And the cattails have a lot of food. There's a whole book about it, Supermarket of the Swamps, as far as cattails. Every part of the cattail is edible. And the Phragmites are really taking over all the natural cattail areas in the wetlands. The Japanese bittersweet is really chokes out all the trees. Wherever there's roadways, they can really come in and destroy the native plants. So that's actually a really big problem.
I have a question about how people can help in regards to rebalancing the equation. I mean, there's a million and a half, 2 million people in Maine, many, if not most, yet definitely most of whom are not indigenous peoples. And they live on top of those lands that you speak to and refer to. Is there any kind of society or group by which they could open up their lands to traditional gathering, or any ways that they could engage with organizations that are working to take out invasive plants? What are your best recommendations for people who care, who hear the show and are concerned, and maybe not just in Maine, but like there might be models in other areas that people could be paying more attention to?
Mm-hmm. I always actually urge people to grow food, especially native plant species and native medicinals, right in their own yards. So much of the land is private, and I think that's a big problem as far as our traditional life ways of hunting and gathering and moving seasonally and subsistently with the seasons and when and where we needed to go for our food. And so with the privatization of so much of the land, it does make a big problem. I think with your land, growing native plants and also trying to control the invasive plant species. So I'll actually go out with clippers and start clipping the bittersweet to save trees. I do that all the time as far as spring and summer, actually just going out and killing the bittersweet. So you can actually do quite a bit as far as maintaining or getting rid of the invasive plant species. And then planting native medicinals is something else that can be done. Rosemary Gladstar out of Vermont does have a native medicinal organization. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but if you become a member, she'll actually mail you some endangered native plants to start your garden. So Rosemary Gladstar in Vermont does have a native plant species organization conservation efforts. I think those are some easier methods of helping to replenish and rejuvenate the land. And part of that, too, I think, goes into as far as land sustainability and cultural sustainability, and they go together. So when we have, you know, we're fighting the destruction of our lands and our waters, it's also a cultural fight as well. And so I think they need to go hand in hand. So as we work towards clean water and clean land and preserving and conserving our native medicinals and edibles, it's also cultural preservation too. So there's a definite correlation and connection in my eyes with land sustainability, cultural sustainability.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID, a special song from our theme song artist Diane Patterson, and a little more commentary on Indigenous traditions from Sherry Mitchell.
Native American religious beliefs are intrinsically ecological, since they regard nature as sacred. The various tribes who inhabited North America before the European invasion had been here for tens of thousands of years, where they developed economically sustainable hunting and gathering economies that were respectful of the environment. They did not consider themselves ruling over nature, but part of nature. Humanity was sacred, but so were the animals and vegetation that sustained it. Even the soil, the minerals, and the rest of the material world were part of the great chain of being. An assault on a single element of this living fabric was an assault on the whole. Native peoples draw upon ritual to maintain a sustainable relationship with nature. These rituals function as a surrogate for ecological science. Instead of measuring soil acidity in a test tube or attaching radio transmitters to bears, they simply relied on empirical observation of the environment that they had mastered. For example, the Hopi Indians had identified 100 different plant types in their ecosphere and knew the role of each one. There is even evidence that they had learned from mistakes in their past and adjusted their practices to account for these mistakes. If overfishing or hunting had punished a tribe with famine, then it developed a myth to explain the dangers of such practices. Our modern scientific society has no myths that function in this manner. We simply exhaust all fishing stock in the oceans because there is profit in it for some. Native peoples recognized that waste of natural resources was insane, especially for profit. The Paiute of Nevada tell a story of a trapper who caught a coyote. When the trapper was about to shoot the animal, it told him, "My friend, we as people have found it necessary to warn you against trapping us, taking from our bodies our skins and selling them for your happiness." This story warns of the dangers of exploiting other living beings for profit, and as history has proven, mankind is now suffering from that very mindset on a grand scale. In essence, the attitude Native peoples took toward the environment was one of restraint. The role of their mythology and spiritual practices was to reinforce this behavior. When the Menominee of Wisconsin gathered wild rice, they made sure that some of the rice fell back into the water the next year so that there would be future crops. In other instances, reseeding was the subject of special prayers. For example, when a Seneca located medicinal herbs, he would build a small ceremonial fire. After the flames died, he would throw a pinch of tobacco on the ashes and pray. I will not destroy you, but plant your seeds that you may come again and yield four more. After harvesting the plants, he would break off the seed stalks, drop the pods into a hole, and cover them with leaf mold. Then he would speak these words, "The plant will come again, as I have not destroyed life, but helped to increase it." Practices like these still inform traditional Native American ecological engagement. The relationship that they have with the ecosystem is one of mutual respect, for they recognize that when you protect and honor the right of nature to exist, you also secure your own right to exist. Now let's return to our conversation with Dr. Jess Cree. I think we can talk about the sustainability of relationships because, you know, one of the things that I think is problematic about our modern society is that we tend to look at relationships the same way that the patriarchy has looked at us as, you know, short-term conquests. And being able to have these long-term sustainable relationships with the land teaches us how to engage in long-term healthy relationships with other living beings, including human beings. And so, you know, this whole idea of sustainability is really about being able to sustain our lives in harmony and in this symbiotic way that allows for the regeneration and the continuation of all life going forward, which is really an important part of the whole equation. So I want to talk a little bit about relationships and how developing this relationship with the land actually impacts who you are as a human being and how it impacts the way that you engage other people. In your experience in working with the plants and the medicines, have you noticed how that process has impacted you personally in regard to your relationship with the earth and your relationship with other people, and how that influences the way that you engage, you know, your own way of being in the world?
I do. So I have an elder teacher who said we basically have four teachings: respect, 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 and respect. And so when you look at the land as a living organism, when you look at it as a living relative, when you look at the plants as healing us and providing us with medicine, their spirits are alive. When you look at the water as alive and as medicine, when you look at the rocks as healing and having wisdom, when you look at the from this indigenous perspective of everything being alive, and we're all related and we're all equal, it comes down to, you know, respect. And so there, when you treat everything with that respect and love, then I think that correlates with how you live your life in general and your belief system and how you treat other people. You would never treat somebody poorly. You would always be out of the utmost respect, knowing that they're alive and that they have a spirit and they have a soul and belief. And so I do. I think it's, again, all about respect, and having that relationship is, like you said, really, really important in our core value that's even based out from our fundamental creation stories of our relationship with the trees, our relationship with the syrup, our relationship with the land that we're on, the soil. Even the soil is so important. So when you look at the soil as a living organism, and I love this teaching from Roger Paul because he's a great language teacher, and he was telling us the word for soil is dupkwai, and I might be pronouncing it wrong, but what it means is it brings forth life. And so he was contrasting that to the belief that of calling it dirt. And so everything is dirty, or the soil is dirty. And so he was contrasting our word for soil, which is bring forth life, life-giving organisms, and contrasting that to the language and the word dirt, and how that, just that alone, can show you the differences in the belief system based on our language. So the language, too, teaches quite a bit about our environment and our relationship with our environment. And so when you look at the soil as a living organism, and it is, and that's the thing about science, too, is that science is now kind of catching up to all of our indigenous knowledge. So we do know that soil is alive. All the probiotics and the bacteria in the soil are so vital for every single cell in our body. Every cell and every chronic health condition needs our probiotics, our flora, for our digestion and absorption. So we actually now know in science that soil is alive. And so when you look in just our indigenous perspective of how we treat the soil, how we need to nourish it, how we would go and gather the seaweeds from the ocean and replenish the soil to rebuild its nutrients, just on the way we talk about soil as a life-giving, how it's going to bring us our food, how important soil is, contrast that to the colonizers as far as dirt being dirty or, you know, not good for us. So it is a belief system. It is a relationship. It's something we need to foster and nourish and abide by, because that soil is our life and it gives us life. And so when we look at it in that way, it totally has a brand new perspective.
You're reminding me of one of our guests who's been on the show, Larry Spotted Crow Man, who really brought up that the indigenous peoples of North America are this continent's first scientists. And he brought it up to remind the non-indigenous listeners to the show that we have such a narrow definition of science from a westernized perspective, and that we need to rethink that. And that's a big theme that's circulating inside me as I'm listening to you, and just remembering that those of us who come from backgrounds that are non-indigenous to North America, we have to really reflect deeply on the path that our grandfathers and our great-grandmothers and our great-great-great-granduncles chose to take, sometimes not very willingly and sometimes extremely willingly, and to go in the direction that has taken us to today. But to remember that that was a path, that was a choice, and that we're at a time of crisis, and crisis is always a crossroads, where we are being forced under pressure to make a different choice, or we're going to walk on the path that leads off the cliff of extinction. So I'm really remembering, you know, some parallels of walking on paths and making choices that are not leading to a life-affirming society and are leading to our own destruction. And one of the things that comes to mind just briefly is the idea of the commons, that the commons is a concept that anyone of European descent should be familiar with, because that is our original system, that it was not about private ownership of an entity or an object that we call nature, but rather managing the relationships of our human species to a shared relationship of another species, a forest or a waterway. So I guess one of the questions that comes to mind for you, Dr. Jess, is this idea of healing and transformation and returning and recentering, because that's really sounds like it's at the root of the work that you do, both as a naturopathic physician and also in that interrelation of culture and medicine. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are for listeners, both of indigenous and non-indigenous backgrounds, on how to turn back on the path or turn forward on the path or whatever the direction is. What first steps do they take if they are listening and they know that our culture, dominant culture, is wildly out of whack and it's dangerous and destructive, and that they themselves, as part of it, are also out of alignment? How do they turn to a new way, and how do they find their way back home?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think science can be pretty helpful. It is, I would say, catching up to traditional knowledge as far as we are learning great things as far as why the berries are so helpful to our health, as far as full of antioxidants and bioflavonoids. And I think the answer is actually very simple. It's to acknowledge that the traditional knowledge is just that, that is knowledge, and we need to recognize it. And that our plant medicine, our herbal medicine, our traditional whole foods are healing. And so when we look at recognizing traditional beliefs as fact and as knowledge and as wisdom and as science, then we can understand that we can use diet and foods and botanical medicine as our primary care. And that goes for everything and everybody. So our very simple way is just recognizing, first off, that our herbal medicine and our foods are medicine and healing, and that pharmaceuticals are there and they can be very helpful, but they're definitely overused and overprescribed. And our traditional foods and our traditional medicines, as far as our plants, are underutilized and not respected. And I also think, not only just the simple using our medicine, so using our plant medicines, using our food as medicine, but also recognizing that our health is directly connected and correlated with the health of the environment. So if we have polluted water, and if we have pollution and polluted lands and fracking and the oil industry with oil leaks and pipelines, and if we continue on this industrialized path, our health will be greatly affected. So we are not above anything else in the environment, and we rely on clean air to breathe and clean water to drink. And so if we do not have clean air to breathe, we are going to have asthma and COPD. If we do not have clean water to drink, then we are going to be getting cancer. With the amount of chemicals and pesticides and contaminants that are being flooded into our environment, that has a direct impact on us as our health. And so it appalls me. It's kind of such a disconnect that people don't understand that their health is directly connected and correlated to the environment's health. And so just recognizing and understanding that alone. So as far as us being consumers in this day and age, you know, not buying chemical-ridden products, not buying hair or beauty care products or shampoo or all of these, not feeding into that chemical industry because it is polluting our bodies. I think cancer is heading to be 1 in 2 people, the cancer rates. So I think right now it's 1 in 4, almost 1 in 3, and the predictions are that it will soon be 1 in 2. And so cancer, We didn't have cancer traditionally. We didn't have any of these chronic diseases that we have today, diabetes, obesity, heart disease. I mean, I can go on and on, autoimmune illnesses. I treat people all day long, and a lot of it does come down to the chemicals and the pesticides. I do heavy metal testing as far as lead and mercury and arsenic and cadmium and how that builds up in the body and creates autoimmune illness and chronic inflammation. And so people just, I think, need to recognize and realize that our health, that we are the earth, that we are a part of that, and we need simple, basic things as far as clean air, clean water. We need our plant medicines. We need our traditional foods, and we need the earth to be basically not polluted for our own health.
When I was living in Arizona, one of the things that I was able to learn about was the Tohono O'odham had a cultural foods program where they have extremely high rates of diabetes and other illnesses, food-related illnesses, that they were able to reduce drastically by putting people back on a pure cultural foods diet. They began programs to harvest their traditional foods. They opened restaurants in their area serving only traditional foods. So returning to our traditional foods is a pathway to health. And so as we're working to regain our health, to try to find a way to get our bodies more in harmony with the rest of creation and to recognize the harmonious connection between our bodies and the rest of creation in regard to extinction, being aware of the foods that we eat and how we protect those foods. As you're saying, you know, we need the air, we need clean water. We also need arable soil. The soil is being so damaged and desertified through all of these big agro processes that it's unusable for years after they're done with it. And so, you know, we need to protect all of these elements of our survival. They're not resources. They're the sources of our survival if we're going to go forward. And like Larry said, and you know Larry, you know, when he was on the show, that our people were the first scientists in this area, and we had learned how to work in harmony with the world around us. So as we're heading towards the end of the show, what are some of the things, specific things that we might be able to do in order to engage that process, to recognize our connections to the natural world and to recognize that, like you said, we're not above being endangered. We are an endangered species right now, human beings on this planet. And how do we rectify the danger that we've created not only for other living beings, but for ourselves, and start realigning ourselves with the pathway that we want to take going into the future for the next generations?
Well, it's a really good question. I think that's the answer we're all looking for. I think, unfortunately, so much of our land and earth is being destroyed by means that are kind of outside of our control as far as the political regime that's in power and the choices and decisions that they're making. So I feel like we really need to use our voices as a collective and tell them that it's not okay, that we need our environment at a certain standard, that we can't have the pollution in going into our groundwater and into our air. So we really have to kind of teach people, educate people on the importance of not destroying our land and our waterways and our airways, and, you know, using our voices in a collective way. I also think how we treat ourselves and how we treat each other and the way that we are treating ourselves. So, you know, your body is your vessel. That is, you know, it should be respected. And so what you put into your body, paying attention, you know, everything you're drinking, everything you're consuming as far as foods and sodas, and trying to clean up yourself so that you can be a role model for those near you, you know. So I think we need to work together collectively to say no to the contaminants and the pollution, and that goes for our food and everything that we are consuming. So it's on an individual level as far as the power that we have, but also we need to use our collective voice.
That's a great advice to people, and really an important one when we're talking about the connection of medicine and culture, but also the health of the planet, but the health of the culture, and then the health of the individual within that culture. But it really, none of it can be separated from the other, can it? I want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Dr. Jess Cree, who is a naturopathic physician, a Penobscot woman, and also has a degree in ethnobotany. Now, she's been doing a really great job of giving us so much to think about in this show, but I'm going to challenge her to take a few minutes now at the end of the program and just give our listeners one last thing to ponder about the work and the role of systems and practices, workshops, education, whatever it is that help us, if we are Indigenous, then help to preserve the Indigenous traditions, or if we're non-Indigenous, help us to learn to respect them. What is the role of education, and what are the challenges around that, the teaching of those traditional processes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think each one of us has a part to share. So each one of us on an individual level has so much to share with the community. And so I don't have all the answers. You know, my specialty is with plants and medicine and foods, and then hunters, or, you know, other fishermen, hunters, they have pieces too. Each individual has their specialty or their practice or their passion for what they love. And each one of us gives something back to the community. So all of us have to make our small piece for our, the health and well-being of our planet Earth, and also for ourselves and each other. And so I think no matter what it is you do or what your profession, there's something in it that you can offer as far as healing and knowing that you're a sacred being and helping us all to heal and a collective whole. So I think each one of us has kind of a missing link, a missing piece in the puzzle to kind of reconnect. So right now we're all disconnected, and politically that might have been planned effort to disconnect us, but we need to put the pieces back together, and I think we each have part of the solution within us. So I do think educating each other, but also growing together and learning from each other is an important part too. And each one of us, I do believe, has something to offer.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's just been such a pleasure to have you on the show with us today. I've learned from you. I know that you've come to some of my lectures, and I have an incredible amount of respect for what you do and what you offer. It's so, when I go to one of your workshops, or, you know, when we're making medicines together, I just feel so completely grounded in who I am, because it's so much a part of who I am from the very beginning. And not only that, but the relationships of the being togetherness that comes out of those times of us telling stories and laughing and just being with one another, bringing in people from all different walks of life within our community who often get fragmented. And so that togetherness piece is kind of the cement that holds it all together. And, you know, I just want to honor you for really holding your peace in such a wonderful way in the world. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution. Love, love, love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Dr. Jess Cree, for joining us and discussing with us the importance of matching our ecological and cultural practices with our health and well-being in the world. I'd also like to thank my co-host, Rivera Sun, for helping bring these engaging discussions with me to the airways every week. She always adds something that is enlightening and inspiring. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to you, Sherry, for suggesting this wonderful guest and letting this amazing conversation unfold, and for the perspectives that you bring to it. You can find more of Sherry's wisdom on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page, the link to which can be found on the Love and Revolution page and on the podcast. We also have a new Love and Revolution Facebook page, so give us a like and you'll find the podcast links there to share with your friends. This is a weekly radio program that can be broadcasted on your local radio station. If you give the station manager a call, they're often happy to fit it into their programming. We can be reached via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Today, Dr. Jess Cree shared with us traditional ecological knowledge and discussed many of the ways that that knowledge is infused into our daily lives. There are many people out there who have lost their connections to this knowledge over time. However, all ancient cultures had this wisdom as part of their cultural traditions. One of the things that Dr. Cree talked to us about today was the importance of reconnecting ourselves to the sources of our survival. So I'm going to challenge you, listeners, to take some time in the coming weeks to look around to see how you can reconnect yourself to the land, to the water, to the air, to the other life that exists around you in this ecosystem, and figure out how you can reconnect by the time we talk to you next week.